going to avoid spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings. And I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Today's primary day in Maryland. In one closely watched race, former Congressmember Donna Edwards is seeking to win back her old seat in Maryland's 4th congressional district outside Washington, D.C. She's facing the corporate attorney Glenn Ivey, who's raised 7 times as much money. The New York Times reports a new super PAC run by AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, has spent nearly $6 million on the primary race in an attempt to defeat Edwards, who served in Congress for 4 terms, ending in 2017. In 2008, Donna Edwards made history, becoming the first Black woman elected to Congress from Maryland. Another group with ties to AIPAC, the Democratic Majority for Israel, has spent over $425,000 to help defeat Edwards. The two groups also poured money into efforts to defeat other progressive Democrats, including Nina Turner in Ohio and Jessica Cisneros in Texas. We're joined now by Peter Beinart, editor-at-large with Jewish Currents. He recently wrote an article headlined, "The Israel Lobby's New Campaign Playbook." Peter Beinart is professor at the Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at City University of New York. Thanks so much for joining us, Peter. Can you talk about what Donna Edwards is confronting right now in Maryland, the level of money that's being poured in to defeat her?
It's really extraordinary for a House race to see one organization, one super PAC, spending almost $6 million. What we're seeing across the country is that AIPAC's super PAC is often spending as much as the campaigns themselves are spending. Partly this is the result of Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision in 2010 that created super PACs, which are these entities that can accept unlimited amounts of money and spend unlimited amounts of money, as long as they are theoretically not coordinated with the campaign. And it's also the result of the fact that AIPAC and allied establishment pro-Israel organizations saw a threat starting in 2019 when people like Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez were elected to Congress and have decided to spend virtually unlimited amounts of money to ensure that their brand of politics, which is more pro-Palestinian rights, but which is also more progressive on economic issues, does not become the future of the Democratic Party.
And, Peter, could you talk about what you discovered in terms of connections or ties between groups like mainstream Democrats and other pro-Israel lobbies like the Democratic Majority for Israel?
Yes. One of the things that I found is that very often when these establishment pro-Israel organizations target a progressive candidate, those candidates are also targeted by groups that are not focused on Israel-Palestine, but simply want to defeat that person because that person may be too progressive on questions of health care, or they may support the Green New Deal. So there's a group called Mainstream Democrats. If you look at their website, it says nothing about Israel-Palestine whatsoever. It just says it doesn't want the Democratic Party to be taken over by far-left groups. But Mainstream Democrats is actually run by Democratic Majority for Israel. So what you see is this very, very close alliance. They work out of the same offices with the same staff. So essentially, this extremely close relationship between groups that want to defeat progressives because they support Palestinian rights and groups that just want to defeat progressives because they essentially want the Democratic Party to be dominated by people like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who will do the bidding of the fossil fuel industry, the healthcare industry, the financial services industry.
And how successful have these efforts been in the past? Amy mentioned the races of Nina Turner in Ohio and Jessica Cisneros in Texas, both of whom were targeted at, by AIPAC and both of whom lost their races. What's been the track record of these efforts?
These efforts, sadly, have been very successful. There have been a couple of races, one in Pennsylvania, one in Illinois, where the progressive candidates were able to win. But in most cases, the candidates targeted have lost. And even when the targeted candidates don't lose, it has a chilling effect. Politicians out there see this and think, I do not want millions and millions of dollars dumped into a House race against me. And so what it tends to do is lead candidates who might be more inclined to take progressive positions on Palestinian rights or on other issues to instead keep their heads down and not take those positions in order to try to avoid the kind of attacks that other progressives have faced.
So let me ask you, back on Donna Edwards' race, Peter, you have the Speaker of the House, right, Nancy Pelosi, who actually comes from Maryland, though she represents San Francisco, coming out in full support of Donna Edwards. Now, while most of the big money spent in the race has come from AIPAC-aligned super PAC, the ads funded by the so-called United Democracy Project don't mention the Middle East. And I wanted then to talk about Nancy Pelosi, who really came out and attacked the kind of money, the attack ads by the AIPAC-aligned groups like United Democracy Project, prompting this response in June from House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi. This is what she said.
When Donna Edwards first represented Maryland's 4th Congressional District, and that was for nearly a decade, she was one of the most effective members in Congress. Donna fought hard for Prince George's County, for jobs and investments in her community, to help constituents in need, and to deliver results. As Speaker and then as leader, I knew I could always count on Donna Edwards as a valued member of our leadership team.
So that's Nancy Pelosi endorsing Donna Edwards. Now, the ads often, and the candidates who are supported by these massive—I mean, the massive amount of money, millions in the case of this campaign going to her opponent— they're not raising the issue of Israel and Palestine, right? And also, let's be clear, there are other pro-Israel groups like J Street, more progressive, that supports Donna Edwards.
Yes, but J Street doesn't only has a small fraction of the amount of money that AIPAC and Democratic Majority for Israel have on the other side. But you're exactly right. In almost none of these races do the attack ads actually have anything to do with the actual agenda of the organizations that are paying for them. And that's because AIPAC and DMFI know that not very many voters in these districts actually really care that much about Israel-Palestine. They care about local issues. So what AIPAC does is DMFI do, they do poll testing, and they attack people on these kind of whatever they think may gain traction. So in Ohio, in the Nina Turner race, because Nina Turner was a Bernie Sanders supporter who had been critical of Joe Biden, they painted her as not a loyal Democrat. In the case of Donna Edwards, they're claiming that she didn't provide good constituent service when she was the congresswoman early on, as if AIPAC or DMFI could care less about the level of constituent service that Donna Edwards provided to her constituents when she was a congresswoman. I mean, it's transparent nonsense, right? It's just that this is their vehicle for trying to defeat her, because Donna Edwards in the past has shown some minimal, right? She's hardly radical on the subject, but just some modest concern for Palestinian human rights. For that reason, they want to defeat her.
Can you talk about the role of Bakari Sellers in these campaigns?
Yes. So Bakari Sellers is a former South Carolina politician with close ties to AIPAC, who has been now heads another super PAC. That is devoted primarily at this point to defeating Rashida Tlaib in Michigan. And its claim is that it's an organization that wants to elect black Democrats. And Rashida Tlaib has a black opponent. But again, this is also transparent nonsense, as if AIPAC and its donors are really concerned about increasing black representation. They're going after Rashida Tlaib for one reason only, because she's a Palestinian member of Congress who is a passionate and eloquent defender of the humanity of Palestinians. And she brings that issue to the fore in Congress like no one else does. But again, because that agenda itself, if laid out nakedly, would not be very popular, you have these transparent claims that it's really about something else, in this way about the claim that somehow, because she's not black, she can't represent a district in Michigan, even though, in fact, she has strong black support and has been a very, very tireless defender of the people in her district of all races.
And Peter, interestingly, there is also a governor's race in Maryland, both competitive primaries in both the Democratic and the Republican parties to elect a successor to the Republican Governor Hogan. But has AIPAC been involved in those races at all, or is it only concentrating on these congressional races?
AIPAC's focus has overwhelmingly been not just in congressional races, but in Democratic primaries in congressional races. AIPAC's assessment has been that because of partisan polarization, there are fewer swing districts, which means that more often than in the past, the member of Congress is chosen in the primary. They also have noticed that there are an unusually large number of open House seats this year because of redistrict and retirement. And they like to do open House races because once an incumbent has been elected in our system, they can be difficult to dislodge. So what this play is really about is trying to create a whole new generation of younger Democrats in Congress who will toe the AIPAC line on Israel-Palestine, also, in many, many cases, also take a kind of more pro-corporate position and therefore blunt the trend that we were seeing towards the Democratic Party moving in a more progressive direction.
We just have 30 seconds, but this is new, right? AIPAC having this kind of super PAC.
Yes. AIPAC, despite its name, never had a political action committee, but it saw, essentially, that it needed to roll out the big guns in response to the trends that we saw with the election of the squad members, and it has extraordinary financial resources at its disposal. Several people, for instance, have given written million-dollar checks already, and the money is still being tabulated.
Peter Beinart, editor-at-large of Jewish Currents. We'll link to your new piece, Israel Lobby's New Campaign Playbook. Israel advocacy groups have developed strategies to raise huge sums for their candidates by appealing to corporate interests.
Welcome to the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Reed. At Mondo Weiss, we cover the movements, activists, and policymakers who affect the struggle for freedom in Palestine. Last month, a U.S. Court of Appeals upheld an Arkansas law that prohibits state contractors from boycotting Israel. The 9-1 decision reversed a previous ruling that determined the law was unconstitutional. Despite the fact that over 30 states have adopted similar laws, it was the first full federal appeals court ruling on the subject. The decision was written by Judge Jonathan Cobes, a Trump appointee the American Bar Association rated as unqualified when he was nominated. The Arkansas story dates back to 2018, when a local paper, the Arkansas Times, refused to sign a pledge promising to refrain from boycotting Israel in order to obtain an advertising contract with a public university. The paper's publisher, Alan Leverett, sued the state over the law and was represented by the ACLU. Leverett has said he's not a supporter of the BDS movement, but launched the complaint over First Amendment concerns. Our U.S. correspondent Michael Aria spoke with Amal Thabata, the Michael Ratner Justice Fellow at Palestine Legal, about the ruling and its potential legal impact going forward.
Yeah, this story kind of begins in 2018 when the Arkansas Times sued the state over its anti-BDS law. I think a lot of listeners probably know the details in the case, but for people who might not be familiar, can you just briefly explain what that Arkansas law entailed and why the paper launched the lawsuit?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's helpful to give some context into anti-BDS laws a little bit more generally. So, since 2014, anti-boycott legislation targeting the movement for Palestinian rights has been introduced in federal and state and local legislators and even adopted by executive order. This type of legislation generally attempts to use economic coercion to suppress boycotts, primarily through prohibitions on state contracts with and state investment in individuals and entities that boycott in support of Palestinian rights. And this is what the Arkansas anti-boycott law is all about. This state law forces entities and individuals who are doing business with the state to sign a contract or a pledge stating that they will not boycott Israel or territories controlled by Israel. The law also calls for the creation of a blacklist of companies that boycott Israel, and even requires public retirement systems to divest from these companies. So in late 2018, in December, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit challenging this Arkansas anti-BDS law on behalf of the Arkansas Times, a local newspaper. And newspaperman and publisher of the Times, Alan Leverett, not only refused to sign the pledge, but he also sued the state. The paper doesn't take a stance on the boycott, and Leverett himself even expressed that he doesn't support it. But he didn't believe that the state should have the right to tell his paper or any other business whether it could participate in a political movement. So the paper lost a lot of ad revenue when its biggest advertiser, a state college in Arkansas, said that it would no longer advertise unless the Times took the pledge that it wouldn't boycott Israel. And, you know, the publisher, Leverett, was, you know, stated he was really surprised when he received an ultimatum from the university, you know, a longtime advertiser, when they said, you know, to continue receiving its ad dollars, they would have to certify in writing that their company was not engaged in a boycott of Israel. He described it to be, you know, like really puzzling. He says that although boycotting Israel couldn't have been further from their minds, and though state funding is a significant source of their income, their answer was no, because they don't take political positions in return for advertising. He believed that if he signed the pledge, they'd be signing away their right to freedom of conscience. And as journalists, they would be, quote, unworthy of the protections granted to them under the First Amendment. So in January 2019, the district court dismissed the case. And almost a year later, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed that decision, finding the law unconstitutional. And this decision was monumental. It was the first time a federal appeals court had decided on the constitutionality of anti-boycott laws. However, unfortunately, in response, the state moved for a larger panel of judges to rehear the case. And just this past month, in June 2022, the Eighth Circuit upheld the Arkansas law, finding it constitutional. And that's where we currently stand today.
I wanted to talk about this specific ruling, which was written by this judge, Jonathan Cobes, who is a conservative. He was appointed by Donald Trump. He, in his decision, he wrote that the law, quote, only prohibits economic decisions that discriminate against Israel. Because those commercial decisions are invisible to observers unless explained, they are not inherently expressive and do not implicate the First Amendment, end quote. I'm wondering what you make of that interpretation from a legal perspective. We've seen a lot of these laws fall apart when they hit the courts. And even, you know, I think we've seen these anti-BDS laws, they've kind of became recalibrated a little after they were challenged. And now you see, you know, these, you see them written in a way where it has to be a certain amount of employees. It has that, you know, the company has to make over $100,000. So I'm just wondering what you make of this decision in the context of, in the context of the precedent and the history we've already seen. Does this strike you as a departure? And what do you think? Do you think this potentially opens up floodgates for similar decisions and rulings when in terms of challenging these laws?
You know, this is all happening in the context of the broader coordinated and well-financed efforts by Israel-aligned groups to stifle a viewpoint in favor of Palestinian rights, as well as the long history of the tactic of boycotts to advocate for social change and the importance of the role of the courts in protecting First Amendment rights. So when the Eighth Circuit issued its ruling upholding the district court's original decision, you know, the full court refused to recognize the free speech components of the case, claiming, like you mentioned, that economic and commercial decisions are invisible and not inherently expressive conduct, and that therefore the law was not in violation of First Amendment speech rights. So under the court's interpretation of Claiborne, the Constitution would only protect entities that are advocating for a boycott, but not actually engaging in a boycott. So taking the facts of Claiborne under this reading, the NAACP would be allowed to advocate for the boycott of white establishments to challenge a political system that denied Black people basic rights without being punished, but actually engaging in a boycott would be punishable. So does this decision feel like a departure from existing precedent to me? It absolutely does. The court's decision departs from longstanding traditions. It ignores the fact that this country was founded on a boycott of British goods and that boycotts have been a fundamental part of American political discourse ever since. This ruling, you know, truly does ignore that history and precedent, treating the state law as a restriction on purely commercial conduct that carries no political message. And this decision is an attack on our right to dissent from the status quo. In upholding the Arkansas anti-BDS law, the court refused to confront the reality that these laws are part of an effort to shield Israel from accountability. And, you know, given the proliferation of anti-boycott laws targeting other social justice movements, this decision also really sets a dangerous precedent for anyone interested in seeking social or political or economic change. For example, the reasoning used by the Eighth Circuit could be used to justify laws that prohibit the state from contracting with companies that boycott fossil fuel companies, for example, laws that, you know, Kentucky, Oklahoma, and Texas recently passed. So we know that these bills, these anti-BDS bills, are meant to target and punish advocacy for Palestinian freedom, but the court's ruling makes it easier for states to target any type of activism that they don't like under the guise of economic well-being. And this decision, you know, yet again underscores that our legal system is not a safety net. The law, Constitution, and Supreme Court have all been used at times to uphold discriminatory and violent policies. And advocacy for Palestinian rights exposes parts of the cracks in the country's foundation, where rights like that to free speech don't apply to those who challenge the injustices of the U.S. or its allies. And that's why it's so important, you know, in my opinion, to continue to raise awareness and to organize because we're seeing that with each new wave of Israeli violence, there's further awareness, sympathy, and organizing for Palestinian rights. You know, the movement won't let rulings like these stop them. History shows us that bad decisions by courts can't stop a principled justice movement. So even as these battles play out in courtrooms and capitals, the critical work of organizing continues towards our ultimate goal, which is freedom and justice in Palestine and the U.S. and beyond.
I realize this situation is very fluid. It's hard to predict, obviously, what happens next. The ACLU, who represented the paper, has said that they're looking into next steps, at least last time I checked, they hadn't appealed yet. But do you have any indication of what might come next with this particular fight? And if there is an appeal, is this a case that could potentially make its way to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I absolutely see this ruling impacting future rulings on anti-BDS laws. You know, like I mentioned, this ruling was just wrong on precedent and history. And I think it'll have serious implications for everyone's free speech rights. And I think as of yesterday, the ACLU confirmed its plans to appeal to the Supreme Court. That being said, you know, we're not under any illusions that the Supreme Court will act to protect fundamental rights. There is some hope that they will have some sympathy for free speech rights. I think that this uncertainty underscores the critical need for organizing, like I mentioned, going beyond legal challenges to build the political will to repeal these problematic laws. And, you know, as always, continuing to advocate for Palestinian rights, including via boycott campaigns, targeting entities that are complicit in Israel's violations of Palestinian rights. So I think a Supreme Court ruling overturning or narrowing Claiborne could have a significant impact on First Amendment rights more broadly, and not only in terms of chilling Palestinian rights advocacy, but other movements as well. It's important to note that these anti-BDS laws are targeting such a small subset of activism and focus primarily on state investments and contracts. So, you know, even if these laws are found to be enforceable as written, there's still a right to boycott. And, you know, BDS is still happening in a lot of different ways that are outside the scope of these laws.
I was wondering if you could talk maybe a little bit about the kind of ironic political context that we see these battles occurring in currently. You know, since the invasion of Ukraine, we've seen all kinds of calls across the political spectrum from political organizations, calls to, you know, boycott and sanction Russia over the action. I read an article the other day that some orchestras were not playing the 1812 overture during July 4th fireworks celebrations because the song was originally written to celebrate Russia defeating Napoleon. So some of these calls are really pretty ridiculous, and they're happening, you know, while these anti-BDS laws are being pushed. Can you talk a little bit about the cultural disconnect there? We're seeing all these calls while states are pushing and upholding laws that are trying to literally make it a crime to boycott Israel. What do you make of that disconnect?
First and foremost, you know, this example with Russia and boycotts demonstrates how boycotts are such a natural response to perceived injustice, and historically such a powerful tool for seeking justice. I also think that the distinctions on how BDS is targeted are important to highlight as well. While the Arkansas decision failed to recognize boycotts as a powerful tool for people to express their views and play a personal role in issues playing out on the global stage, the recent trend of boycotting Russia, while at times misguided, reflects how ingrained the concepts of boycotts are in our society. Unlike these blanket bans on anything perceived to be Russia, BDS is a thoughtful, targeted, and strategic response to entities that are actually complicit in Israel's unfair treatment of Palestinians. I think it's also important to, you know, draw the distinction of the fact that calls to boycott Russian products or individuals are often coming from powerful politicians who have already used their authority to implement governmental sanctions against Russia. So in contrast with BDS, which is trying to use people power to collectively amplify grassroots calls for justice, the boycotts of Russia are a top-down approach that in a sense mirrors the anti-boycott laws themselves, since we also saw a widespread effort from states across the country to boycott and divest from Ben & Jerry's when they decided to stop doing business in illegal Israeli settlements on Palestinian land. But all of this being said, I think that there is, you know, certainly a double standard whenever it comes to Palestine, but an increasing amount of people are seeing Palestine as central to racial justice struggles. And these examples of Russia boycotts really show that Palestine should not be the exception.
And finally, and you already alluded to this a little in one of your previous answers, you know, these laws are obviously dangerous and disturbing on their own terms, but, you know, we're already seeing this, how this logic can be expanded to any form of boycott, and in fact, already has in some parts of the country. I think with some of these states, you know, they don't even have an economic relationship with Israel. It's obviously just kind of like a, you know, a right-wing symbolic piece of legislation. Maybe there's people who don't take it, you know, very seriously because it doesn't necessarily apply to a lot of people. But can you talk about the wider dangers of anti-BDS laws and how they open up kind of a Pandora's box when we talk about, you know, wider crackdowns on activism?
Absolutely. I think like you just mentioned, you know, while these bills, if enacted, chill free speech, you know, by effectively dictating that a position supporting human rights is unacceptable, they also intimidate individuals and businesses from adopting ethical political stances regarding Palestine and Israel, because these individuals know that their decisions based on human rights concerns could result in a denial of a contract with the state. And although these bills typically apply only to public contracts, if enacted, they likely will chill other expressive activity. For example, similar laws have been invoked in order to chill student and community activism in support of Palestinian human rights. They've also been invoked to prevent public talks at universities, to censor school teachers, which we've seen a lot, and to cancel cultural events. So even where these censorship efforts have failed, confusion over the scope or even deliberate misapplication of these anti-boycott laws did in fact chill or punish or attempt to punish speakers supporting Palestinian rights. And in fact, anti-boycott laws have tangible consequences beyond the direct effects of denying contracts and compelling speech. Musicians, teachers, students, professors, and grassroots activists have reported ways that anti-boycott laws have been used to threaten careers, homes, and educations. So the impact of legislation targeting Israel boycotts goes far beyond chilling advocacy for Palestinian rights. And we've seen that, you know, anti-Israel boycott laws have become a model for other types of anti-boycott legislation, targeting protests in support of other social justice issues. A dozen of states have introduced or passed anti-boycott legislation, for example, targeting efforts to address climate change or even gun violence. So given the proliferation of anti-boycott laws targeting other social justice movements, again, like I think this decision specifically sets a really dangerous precedent for anyone that's interested in seeking social, political, or economic change.
Well, thanks so much for chatting with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to our show, a production of MondoWeiss.net. The music is from Sound of Picture. Visit our site to sign up for free daily and weekly newsletters on Palestine, Israel, and related U.S. politics. If you're enjoying our podcast, please consider becoming a donor by visiting MondoWeiss.net/donate. MondoWeiss is a nonprofit publication, and every donation of any amount helps sustain our work. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen, and please leave a rating and review to help other listeners find our show.
When a voice as vital as Shirin Abu Aqla's is silenced, the grief is immeasurable, the pain almost too much to bear. Known by many as the daughter of Palestine, the veteran Al Jazeera journalist was shot dead by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank while on an assignment in the city of Jenin. For her friends and colleagues, the loss has been devastating.
She was born and raised in Jerusalem under occupation. She was telling the story that she was living every day. She was not just telling the story of the people. She was telling the story of her life as well. And this is what made her magically an icon.
Shirin was one of Al Jazeera's first field correspondents, having joined the channel in 1997. Covering the Second Intifada didn't just turn her into a household name, it also transformed her into a role model. On the air, the Palestinian-American trailblazer showcased the power of journalism, while off the air, she taught journalism classes, inspiring women and men to always speak truth to power.
For many of the younger journalists, in fact, for most of us, she was an idol, somebody we would look up to. She knows her facts. She knows the story. She knows how to connect to people. She was sincere. She loved what she did.
Thousands came out in occupied East Jerusalem to pay their respects. But earlier, as the funeral procession began at the St. Joseph Hospital in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, they were confronted with the ultimate sign of disrespect. As mourners were attacked by Israeli forces, pallbearers struggled to prevent Shirin's coffin from hitting the ground. People were pulled out of the hearse. Israeli forces also removed the Palestinian flag.
Everyone was there to support to show their support and love. And at the end of the day, even in her death, it wasn't done peacefully. Even the day of the funeral was violent.
The funeral procession later resumed and reached a cathedral in the Christian quarter of the old city, where a service was held before Shirin was laid to rest next to her parents' gravesite at the Mount Zion Protestant Cemetery.
She went into the hearts of every single Palestinian, and I dare say every Arab household because of her touching reporting and the way that she had of bringing to light the reality of Israel's brutal occupation.
In her reporting, Shireen Abu Akleh combined unwavering strength and steadfast empathy, telling the story of her people as clearly and thoughtfully as possible. Her voice may have gone silent, but it will continue to reverberate. Mohammed Jamjoum, Al Jazeera.
Well, international and Palestinian journalistic organizations, media organizations, they launched an accusation, a case, a formal complaint to the International Criminal Court last month, accusing Israel of committing war crimes against journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists says 24, not including Shireen Abu Akleh, have been killed in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory since 2002. Other press freedom advocates have reported even higher numbers. Well, Israel systematically targets journalists, including Al Jazeera. That's been the finding of several human rights groups. In 2010, it detained several on board a humanitarian flotilla heading to Gaza. Last year, Israel bombed a building with media offices, including Al Jazeera, in the occupied Gaza Strip. And barely a month later, Israeli forces arrested Al Jazeera journalist Jawar Abu-Deiri as she covered a demonstration in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem. Well, earlier I spoke to Pierre Haski. He's the president of Reporters Without Borders. And I asked him about these kinds of events.
No, it hasn't. And the requirements are not there. We've been calling, and many people have been calling, for an international investigation to go to the bottom of this case. We have some experiences already. You know, 35 journalists have been killed in Israel and Palestine in the past 20 years, and none of the investigations carried out by the Israeli army.
Let me jump in, if I could, because you mentioned something really interesting there. You've said that you've been calling on Israel to allow an international investigation. What kind of response do you get from Israeli authorities to that kind of request? Is there any indication that they would be open to an international investigation to cooperate with it?
No, there's no indication yet. The Israeli authorities have been giving the usual response, but we all feel, whether it's the UN security or NGOs like ours, have been calling for an independent inquiry, and that cannot be solely from the Israeli army, and there's no sign yet that Israel is ready to comply. But we think that the pressure is unprecedented on this case, and we are hoping that the Israeli authorities will change their mind on this independent inquiry.
What do you make of how the Israeli position has evolved over time? At the beginning, we heard statements from Israeli officials who were kind of pointing the blame in the direction of the Palestinians. Since then, their statements have kind of taken a different direction to include, at least in their minds, the possibility that they did actually kill Shireen.
Yes, I think it has followed the kind of usual path in the sense that the immediate and automatic response is to blame the Palestinians for what happened. They probably underestimated at that point the outcry that it would generate worldwide. And certainly it has forced the Israeli authorities to pull back on this initial statement and at least leave the door open for their own responsibility if the investigation goes through. But it's not enough. And as I said earlier, we need an independent inquiry. But it's a good sign that the authorities in Israel have been responding to the pressure on their initial statement, which was really baseless.
All right, you mentioned a moment ago there's been no indication that Israel will be open to an international inquiry. Without the internationalization of the investigation, what does that mean for the chances of accountability?
Well, without an international presence, I think there will be no accountability. We have to be very clear about that.
And it's very interesting that in the midst of the Ukraine war and the tension that we have...
Give us an idea when viewers are listening. Why?
Because the record for the past 20 years for the 35 journalists who have been killed, in, particularly in the Palestinian territories, has been no accountability, never, not for a single case. So we have no reason to believe that this will be different this time. And it's very interesting that in the middle of the international divisions, the UN Security Council was able to produce a unanimous statement calling for an immediate, transparent, and thorough investigation into this case. So I think the level of international consciousness on this case is quite unprecedented, and I don't think Israel we can get away with it.
Well, I've got to ask you one more question, since it is also the one-year anniversary since the destruction of that media building housing the facilities of Al Jazeera and Associated Press. How much progress has there been towards any sense of investigation, transparency, or accountability for that?
There's been no progress, to be honest, that can be spoken of, because Israel says it's a, you know, it's the midst of the war. It doesn't take into account that targeting a media building is considered a war crime and is contradicting every international law resolution that exists, particularly Resolution 2222 of the UN Security Council from 2015, which says clearly that journalists should be treated as civilians and therefore cannot be a target in a war. So this is very clear, and there's been no sign yet there again of any accountability.
وطني ليس حقيبة آه يا جرحي المكابر وطني ليس حقيبة
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Previously broadcast program.
An ingenuity.
But above all, it takes a second dose of vaccine.
A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Possibilities. Love itself represents an impossibility.